I fell behind this morning, which is one reason I have to do this, but that happens with this play. So what I'm going to try to tonight just concentrate on the ghost and do a close reading of the encounter with the ghost. Raise some questions, make a few points, a few observations, just so we will know, just so the problem will be posed that's going to hover over the rest of the play. You will not get any easy solutions here tonight, okay? But what we're going to do is a close reading of the text to look at what's there. I want to start in Act 1, Scene 4, when the ghost appears. They have brought Hamlet up to the battlements of the castle where the ghost has been walking and saying that indeed he needs to see it. It looks like the king. We get the contrast done very well in the Zeffirelli film of Hamlet up on the battlements of the castle, the exterior, and looking down through that grating and inside seeing Claudius pounding him down and having a good time. And it's a wonderful visual representation of that external internal problem, or in this case, the huge contrast that I was talking about this morning. The ghost enters. Horatio announces it. Look, my lord, it comes. I'm in Act 1, Scene 4, early in the scene, about line 35. Notice Hamlet's first response, very first response. Angels and ministers of grace, defend us. The initial response of Hamlet is fear. This is unnatural, this is not normal, and calls on angels and ministers of grace, defend us. From what? From the ghost. This is worrying, this is threatening. And that call, I think, is very important. And then it's followed immediately by a statement, be thou a spirit of health or goblin damned. And there in Hamlet's second line, once he sees the ghost, is the problem. And it's almost impossible to resolve. Is the ghost a good ghost or a bad ghost, all right? And it's very difficult to say. It makes all the difference in the world. Question, should Hamlet believe what he is told? Is the ghost there simply to indeed get his son to clean up the territory, if you will, to clean up the evil in Denmark? Or is this a goblin damned that is coming seeking to draw another soul to hell? That is Hamlet. A false ghost who says, kill your uncle, and by that act of blood vengeance, gain another soul for hell. Which is it? The problem is going to hover over the rest of the play. We'll keep going back to it. But it's a very real problem. And Hamlet himself states the problem in his second line addressed to the ghost. Let me go outside the play for just a moment. We have a pattern in the other Shakespeare tragedies, an important pattern. It begins in Julius Caesar, written just before Hamlet. Brutus is the tragic hero. He is tempted by Cassius to commit a murder, and as a result of committing that murder, killing Caesar, Brutus falls. Brutus falls. Othello. Othello is tempted by Iago, clearly evil. He succumbs to the temptation. He kills his wife Desdemona, who is innocent. He falls. We go to Macbeth. Macbeth is tempted by the witches and by Lady Macbeth to kill Duncan. Macbeth kills Duncan. He falls. The only one of the tragedies of this period that does not follow that pattern is King Lear. If we take the ghost to be a spirit of temptation seeking to make Hamlet fall, it follows the pattern. The hero is tempted by a force of evil, succumbs to the force of evil, and falls to his own destruction. That pattern could be playing itself out here. It's a possibility. The very fact that it is not as clear here as it is in the other plays says something about the problems that underlie this play. We can't say for certain. Let's go on and see why it gets complicated. Be thou a spirit of health or goblin damned, bring with thee airs from heaven or blasts from hell. There's the contrast again. Be thy intents wicked or charitable. We might say Shakespeare's underlining the problem here. We're getting that opposition repeated over and over again. Thou comest in such a questionable shape that I will speak to thee. I'll call thee Hamlet, King, Father, Royal Dane. Please notice that the first word addressed to the ghost, the first name the ghost is given, is Hamlet, the hero's own name. If you're reading through this again, do check, because I think you will find Hamlet almost never refers to himself by his own name. When he uses the name Hamlet, he's referring to his father. Until very late in the play, and that's going to become an important moment later. But he calls his father Hamlet, which was the king's name, but it's also his name. And that's what he first says. And then king, and then father. Father comes third. Then royal dame. Oh, answer me, let me not burst in ignorance, but tell why thy canonized bones, hearsed in death, have burst their cerements, why the sepulchre wherein we saw thee quietly inurned hath oped his ponderous and marble jaws to cast thee up again. Why are you here? What do you have to tell me? And the ghost beckons Hamlet away. It will not speak in front of the others, which again raises suspicions. I'm simply going to now, they say, don't, Horatio especially says, don't go. Hamlet goes. I'm going to jump ahead to Act 1, Scene 5. It's indeed at the end of Scene 4, Marcellus has the famous line, something is rotten in the state of Denmark. All right. Act 1, Scene 5. Whither wilt thou lead me? Speak, I'll go no further. Mark me, the ghost says, I will. My hour is almost come, when to sulphurous and tormenting flames must render up myself. And here begins the long debate, is the ghost in hell or is the ghost in purgatory? It makes, obviously, a huge difference. Let me just say that the way the ghost phrases this makes it unclear. Keep it in mind as we continue through with the scene. Hamlet, alas, poor ghost. He pities the ghost. Pity me not, but lend thy serious hearing to what I shall unfold. Speak, I am bound to hear. So art thou to revenge when thou shalt hear. Okay? Before he tells him what this actual situation is, what has happened, he calls for revenge. Hamlet is told what he must do before he's told why he has to do it. Action here, the action precedes the explanation. You've got to revenge me. I'll tell you why in a minute. But it's important that the first call is, you are bound to revenge when thou shalt hear what's happened to me. Hamlet simply asks, what? And here we go. I am thy father's spirit. That's what he's looked like. That's what the assumption is. But we also know, because the lines tell us, the devil hath power to assume a pleasing shape. This may simply be a damned spirit that has appeared looking like Hamlet's father for a very particular reason, and that is to get young Hamlet damned. However, the ghost claims, I am thy father's spirit, doomed for a certain term to walk the night, and for the day confined to fast in fires, till the foul crimes done in my days of nature are burnt and purged away. There's no doubt in the ghost's mind where he comes from. The ghost claims to have come from purgatory. The ghost claims that during the night he has to walk about the earth. In the day he's confined to the fires where his foul crimes done in my days of nature are burnt and purged away. Now, that's the claim the ghost makes, but there's something else going on here that is hugely important. I take you back to this morning's lecture. Please remember that opening soliloquy and young Hamlet's view of his own father. The point he kept making throughout the soliloquy was, my father, old Hamlet, is like the sun god. He is godlike. He is like Hyperion. He is strong. He is noble. He is good. He's like Hercules. He's loving. He's the best husband my mother could have had. He is a very great man. And the contrast is entirely with Claudius, who is none of those things. But in order for the contrast to work, the emphasis of the young prince has been on the greatness of his father. His father's ghost appears, and the first thing that the young prince hears is, "Till the foul crimes done in my days of nature." What is the admission the ghost makes to young Hamlet? I committed foul crimes when I was alive. Apart from what's going on in terms of the burden placed on young Hamlet, please notice that the ghost is also undermining the prince's view of his own father. Why is this important? Because, as I made clear this morning, he's already come to doubt his mother. He's doubting the nature of Gertrude's love for his father. Was it real? Did it matter? Was it something less than noble, something less than it should have been? And now the ghost is coming and making him doubt his father. Foul crimes done in my days of nature are burnt and purged away. The ghost, if he is the real father, is admitting things that the prince has not known. Certainly have not been part of his own view of his father. My point is this. The ghost is there casting more doubt into a mind already consumed with doubt. What was the one thing in the soliloquy young Prince Hamlet had to hold on to? The greatness and nobility of his father. What's the first thing the ghost does? Cast doubt on that as being genuine or true. But that I am forbid to tell the secrets of my prison house, I could a tale unfold whose lightest word would harrow up thy soul, freeze thy young blood, make thy two eyes start like stars, start from their spheres, thy knotted and combined locks to part, and each particular hair to stand on end like quills upon the fretful porpentine. it's a wonderful, wonderful little section. I can't tell you where I am, but if I could tell you, I'd scare you to death. Notice, I committed foul crimes, and I'm in a place that is so horrible I can't even tell you about it. But this eternal blazon must not be to ears of flesh and blood. It's so bad, but I can't tell you about it. It's awful, but I can't tell you about it. If someone does that to you, what's your response? Tell me, I've got to know. Tell me. The ghost is toying with Hamlet. There's no doubt about it. The extended imagery is a tease. Is a kind of tease. There's something very strange there. And then having said, I can't tell you, he now says, list. I can't tell you, but listen. Point I'm making, the ghost is a character. The ghost isn't just a ghost showing up and saying, okay, here's what you need to know. The ghost is not just conveying information. This ghost has a personality and is doing some very strange things, playing certain kinds of games with the young prince. Is it just that it really is his father and his father is oblivious? Or is it a spirit from hell toying with the prince? If thou didst ever thy dear father love. If there's one thing we know so far in the play that we can say with certainty, it's that Hamlet loved his father. His father comes back and what does he say? If you ever loved me. The ghost doesn't seem to be aware of that love. The ghost puts it in terms of, it's a possibility. If thou didst ever thy dear father love, and Hamlet's response is, oh God! You don't know that I loved you? Revenge his foul and most unnatural murder. And there it is. But notice again, it's the action. Revenge me, revenge me. But at least now we get the reason why, because I was murdered. Murder! Murder most foul, as in the best it is, but this most foul, strange and unnatural. Even the best murder is foul, but my murder was particularly bad. Okay? The ghost is beginning a pattern we're going to follow now. The ghost is going to boast about himself a little bit. Oh yeah, murder's always bad, but my murder, most foul, strange and unnatural. Haste me to know it, that I with wings as swift as meditation or the thoughts of love may sweep to my revenge. Hamlet's response is, tell me about it and I'll revenge you right away. Although look at the similes he chooses. With wings, wings lift one up. Wings as swift as meditation. Okay, well, thought is quick. But he says, I'll act as quick as thought, and it's appropriate for this character who is thinking all the time to use that. But notice the next. Or the thoughts of love may sweep to my revenge. Oh, I'll go kill right away as quickly as I would think of love. This is a bizarre contradiction. But not if you remember the problem that's posed earlier in the play, which is indeed questions of love. The one thing he was holding on to, or tried to hold on to, was that love was real. Everything else could be doubted. Everything else was questionable. Love was real. And now it comes out in this simile, well, all right, I'll do it as fast as I can think, and I know I can think, or as fast as I can think about love. What has he got left to him? It seems to be thought, meditation and thoughts of love. Because that's the simile he comes up with, and the ghost says, I find thee apt. Good work, kid. I find thee apt. And duller shouldst thou be than the fat weed that roots itself in ease on leafy wharf, wouldst thou not stir in this. If you don't do it, if you don't do it, you are worse than a fat weed. Wait a minute, where have we seen the image before? Things rank and gross in nature possess it merely, okay? 'Tis an unweeded garden grown to seed. And suddenly the ghost is saying he's using his own image against him. This ghost is damn clever, okay? If you don't revenge me right away, then you're no better than a fat weed, which has already been a very negative image in Hamlet's mind in the soliloquy, that roots itself in ease on leafy wharf. Leafy, the river of forgetfulness. Classical allusion. The underworld river of forgetfulness. And dull doesn't just mean not moving. It means lethargic, inert. Okay? The ghost is also, in a sense, defining the problem that's going to come. The ghost says, you've got to act right away, and if you don't, this is what you'll be. And we're going to have problems with action right from the start. Now, Hamlet, hear. 'Tis given out that sleeping in my orchard, a serpent stung me. Please notice that there's no getting away from the biblical echo here. The good king, as Hamlet viewed it, is out in his garden, and along comes the serpent and does him in. so that we have the sense of at least a hint of the fall. A hint of the fall, where King Hamlet, old King Hamlet, is poor fellow like Adam. The serpent, obvious, Claudius, is like the devil. It's being set up that way. So the whole ear of Denmark is by a forged process of my death rankly abused. But know, thou noble youth, the serpent that did sting thy father's life now wears his crown. Here was Claudius. Oh, my prophetic soul, my uncle. Hamlet says, I knew it. I knew it. He's had suspicions. He now voices those suspicions. So that in a curious way, the ghost is now confirming something he suspected. And now the ghost explodes in anger. I, that incestuous, that adulterate beast. Who was talking about incest before? It was Hamlet. Who was talking about adultery before? There are hints of it from Hamlet. Who viewed his uncle as an animal? The satyr reference, the goat man. The ghost is using Hamlet's own thoughts. So it's not just that Hamlet had suspicions that are being confirmed, but once again, the ghost seems to know what Hamlet's been thinking. He's using his own images. He's using those images we've already come upon. With witchcraft of his wit, with traitorous gifts, a wicked wit and gifts that have the power so to seduce, one to his shameful lust, the will of my most seeming virtuous queen. That is tough stuff and an awful thing to say to this young man at this point. Claudius was clever. He not only killed the king, but used his wit and his gifts and seduced to his shameful lust, underlining the suspicion that young Hamlet has had of the relationship between his mother and King Claudius. The will of my most virtuous queen? My most seeming virtuous queen. His own father has come back from the grave now, if it is his father, to say what to the young man? Your mother appears to the world to be virtuous. If in the first soliloquy, the source of his disturbance was the action of his mother and what it suggested about her character, the ghost now magnifies that, or perhaps we should say underlines that. And gives the sense that the one thing Hamlet seemed to try to hold on to or believe in, that is the love of woman, reflected in his love for Ophelia, is really shaken in the fact that his mother only seemed to be virtuous, and the proof of that is how quickly she falls into the lustful wiles of King Claudius. And we're back to that word, seeming. Seems, madam? Nay, I know not seems, it is. And again, the ghost is echoing Hamlet's language and the very thing he attacked in his first appearance in the court, and that is, everything here is show, nothing is real, there's nothing you can believe in. It all just seems to be an appearance, a fake and phony, but I have that within which is real. And now the ghost is saying, even the virtue of your mother was phony, exterior. My most seeming virtuous queen. Oh, Hamlet, what a falling off was there from me! Whew. Now, this is extraordinary. Your mother's not as virtuous as she pretended to be. Claudius is a beast. She left me to marry him. Boy, did she take a fall. Why? Because she fell from me. Well, one thing that hasn't been burned away from the ghost yet, if he is in purgatory, is pride. Is pride. This is an extraordinary statement to make. Now notice, it echoes what Hamlet himself was thinking. Dad was great. Uncle's a beast. But to have Dad say it is very strange. There's not a lot of humility in this ghost. What a falling off there was from me, whose love was of that dignity that it went hand in hand even with the vow I made to her in marriage. I kept that vow, I kept my dignity, I was top notch, I was solid. What's the question? What's the logical question that comes up? Then what were your foul crimes, Dad? You've already mentioned those. We got problems here. We got problems, okay? Let's keep going. Even with the vow I made to her in marriage and to decline again. And what a decline was there. Boy, did she go downhill. And to decline upon a wretch whose natural gifts were poor to those of mine. Now, you know, you can have brotherly rivalry and all. And yes, Claudius isn't a particularly admirable man, but notice what's being done here. I once had a student ask me in class if the ghost was making a slightly bawdy joke there, talking about the ghost's natural gifts as opposed to Claudius's natural gifts. It's not outside the scope of what this ghost is talking about. Everything about me was better than you, and she declined to that. Okay? This ghost is peculiar. But virtue, as it never will be moved, though lewdness courteth in a shape of heaven. Okay? You cannot move virtue, even though it comes and appears, something appears as if it's heavenly, so lust, though to a radiant angel linked, will sate itself in a celestial bed and prey on garbage. Who's he talking about? He's talking about his widow. He's talking about Gertrude, who, though to a radiant angel linked, excuse me, what are these foul crimes then? The ghost is referring to himself as a radiant angel, then who is the embodiment of lust? Gertrude? Will sate itself in a celestial bed. She was in a heavenly bed. She had all she wanted. Remember why she would hang on him as if increase of appetite did grow by what it fed on. Hamlet himself has been aware of this. She really seemed to love him. She loved him a lot. That love seemed to grow. Well, now the ghost is saying she will sate itself in a celestial bed and prey on garbage. Who's the garbage? Claudius. Good heavens. There is just something truly odd in what the ghost is saying, but please notice he's tossing Hamlet's own thoughts back at him and toying with them, playing with them in a very particular way. But soft methinks I sent the morning air, brief let me be. He goes on for about another 30 lines. He's like Polonius in that way. Polonius's brevity is the soul of wit, he says, going on and on and on. Sleeping within my orchard, my custom always of the afternoon, we're back in that garden again, upon my secure hour, thy uncle stole, with juice of cursed heaven on in a vial, and in the porches of my ears did pour the leprous distillment, whose effect holds such an enmity with blood of man that swift as quicksilver it courses through the natural gates and alleys of the body, and with a sudden vigor it doth posset and curd like eager droppings into milk the thin and wholesome blood. We get a clinical description, a clinical description of the murder. So did it mine. That's what happened to me. And a most instant tetter barked about, most laser-like, with vile and loathsome crust all my smooth body. Get the image. Whoa! He pours this in the ear, it goes in, it curdles in his blood, and suddenly he gets this awful leprous crust all over his body. Oh! Do we need to know these details? Why are we giving these details? Why are we getting, you know, what? Is this information really necessary? Follow this. Thus was I, sleeping, by a brother's hand, of life, of crown, of queen, at once dispatched. Cut off even in the blossoms of my sin. Excuse me, I thought you were a great guy. Excuse me, the last time I talked to you, you were a radiant angel. Now we're back to the foul crimes. And not only that, these sins aren't just new or budding. These sins have blossomed. The weed image is now turned into flowers blossoming, okay? Cut off even in the blossoms of my sin. Unhouseled, disappointed, unannulled. Unhouseled, without the benefit of the Eucharist. It was a synonym, okay? I died without a chance to receive the Blessed Sacrament. Disappointed, okay? Quite literally, not having made the proper appointment, not having been prepared. I went to death totally unprepared, okay? Which would suggest confession and absolution. Totally unprepared and unannulled, without the holy oil, suggesting not having last rites. No confession, no absolution, no last rites, no anointing with holy oil, and without the opportunity to receive the Blessed Sacrament. That's how the ghost says he went into death, in the blossom of his sins, bearing on his shoulders the foul crimes. You know enough about the faith. Is this purgatory? Is this purgatory? Is he coming from purgatory? This is strange stuff here. No reckoning made, but sent to my account with all my imperfections on my head. All! With all my imperfections on my head. But the problem here is, can we believe anything of what this ghost is saying? What sort of logic is there in any of it he's saying? Oh horrible, most horrible. Which I'm fond of telling my students is without a doubt the most horrible line in all of Shakespeare. Anyway, if thou hast nature in thee, bear it not. Now, what's a proper proper response? Okay, here's the situation. I was killed. I went into death with all this, with my foul crimes on me. Your mother, who just pretends to be virtuous but is really filled with lust, has now making a marriage with this guy who's really a beast. Now, don't put up with that, kid. The response should simply... what am I supposed to do? If that's the life you led, if that's what my mother's like, if that's what my uncle is like, what, I'm supposed to just knock off my uncle and everything's going to be fine? Perhaps there's a larger problem here. Or the larger problem may be, this whole thing may be a lie. The larger problem again may well be, what is young Hamlet supposed to believe about anything? Is the ghost truthful? Was his mother truthful? Are the stars fire? Does the sun move? Is truth a liar? Is there real love in the world? You've got to understand that Hamlet is being hit with all of this from the ghost at the time when he is not in the strongest position on his own. And now he's being told what? Clean it up. It's your job to clean this up. If thou hast nature in thee, bear it not. Notice the first order. Let not the royal bed of Denmark be a couch for luxury and damned incest. Not revenge my murder at that point, but what? Get your mother out of that relationship. He jabs him again where he's most susceptible. The vision of his mother in the royal bed of Denmark, which is a couch for luxury and damned incest. But howsomever thou pursuest this act, taint not thy mind. But don't let this disturb your thoughts. Don't do anything. Don't think anything you shouldn't think. I mean, really. Taint not thy mind, nor let thy soul contrive against thy mother aught. Don't do anything to her. Leave her to heaven. At that point, I think most of you realize the line perhaps could or should be rewritten, given what he's been saying about his wife. Now, it means, of course, leave her to the judgment of heaven. But this ghost has said despicable things about his wife, and now he's saying, but don't do anything against her, just leave her alone. And to those thorns that in her bosom lodge to prick and sting her, there is a moment that seems real. Let her conscience bother her. Don't touch her, let her conscience bother her. Although he certainly has said plenty to make us come to the point where we have to doubt a bit the nature of Gertrude's own conscience. Fare thee well at once. The glow-worm shows the matin to be near and gins to pale his ineffectual fire. Adieu, 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 adieu. Remember me. He's gone. My point is this. What on earth are we as theatergoers or readers to make of all that? It goes by so quickly that our impression is, I think, very similar to Hamlet's impression. This is scary, this is frightening, this is overwhelming, and you can count on it. Every performance of Hamlet I've ever seen has a great ghost. It's a great role. It's a wonderful role. And everyone in the audience is just sort of, wow, this is really impressive. And Hamlet at this moment, clearly, is overwhelmed. If you stop and look at what the ghost has said, it's confused and confusing. It is very difficult to sort out. We are left with one gigantic problem. And the main thing it has done, I think, is serve to undermine even further Hamlet's vision of this world in which he finds himself and the people who inhabit it and those people who have raised him. At the same time, the claim is being made, but it's your job to take care of it and do something about it. But look at his response. Look at his response. And all you host of heaven, O earth, what else? And shall I couple hell? O fie, hold, hold my heart. The first response is emotional. And you, my sinews, grow not instant old, but bear me stiffly up. Okay, give me physical courage. Remember thee, I, thou poor ghost, whilst memory holds a seat in this distracted globe. As long as there's any memory in my head, I will remember you, but that distracted globe, that head is distracted. It's more confused now than ever. Remember thee, yea, from the table of my memory I'll wipe away all trivial fond records, all sorrows of books, all forms, all pressures past, that youth and observation copied there, and thy commandment all alone shall live within the book and volume of my brain, unmixed with baser matter. Yes, by heaven, I'll remember what you told me. Yes, I will. And notice the next line. Oh, most pernicious woman! He says, I'll remember, I'll remember, I'll never forget what you told me, I will remember, and he starts to speak of it, and who does he attack? His mother. The first attack is not on Claudius. The action he's been told to take is against Claudius, but the next words out of his mouth are, oh, most pernicious woman. And again, the one thing my supposition, that he could hold to, which was the love of woman, is now being shaken. And it's been further shaken by the ghost. And that's why that first outburst is against his mother. And then we get, oh, villain, villain, smiling, damned villain, my tables. And he pulls out the little notebook, although I love the thing that Gibson did of trying to write on the rocks with his sword and the sparks flying. That was a nice touch. My tables, meet it is I set it down, that one may smile and smile and be a villain. Once again, what's the problem? There's no connection between exterior and interior. We're back to my most seeming virtuous queen. But break my heart, for I must hold my tongue. You can't get any sort of connection between the outward show and what's actually going on inside. One may smile and be a villain. At least I am sure it may be so in Denmark. So Uncle, and he writes it down. Please notice, what did he promise the ghost? I'll move as swift as meditation or thoughts of love. I'll sweep to my revenge. What's he doing? He's writing in his little book. We're back to words and books. He just said, I'll wipe everything from my mind of all the books, everything that was ever... Where's my book? I got to write something down. And there is a reason why, we'll see this again very soon, there's a reason why he has to remain, if you will, trapped in language. Language is all he's got at this moment. So, Uncle, there you are. Now to my word. Now to my word. It is adieu, remember me, I have sworn it. Well, now, just a moment. What did he swear to? Just to remember? The question is, remembering is not the same as the actual killing. Thought he swore to vengeance, now he's saying, no, it is adieu, remember me, I have sworn it. Well, I've sworn to remember you. But there's a lot of other information that was handed out beyond just, Claudius killed me. Now, I'm skipping over the rest of the scene. Just going to the very end. The ghost makes them swear on the sword. The echo of the voice coming from beneath the stage. They swear not to ever speak of what they saw that night. We're at the end of Act One. Hamlet's final speech at the end of Act One. Rest, rest, perturbed spirit. So, gentlemen, with all my love, I do commend me to you. And there is something true here insofar as, and he's going to say it again very soon, Horatio is particularly dear to him. That friendship is important, as are these other guards. I think that's genuine. And what so poor a man as Hamlet is may do to express his love and friending to you, God willing, shall not lack. Why the importance on the love of friendship right now, after all of this? To me, it's fairly clear. That's all he's got left to depend on, and he does trust these guys. He does trust Horatio. But his sense of connection with the rest of the world has been brutalized and broken down until he can trust Horatio and he can trust these men. When they swear on the sword, he believes them. And he comments on it after this act in which everything has been thrown up for grabs. Let us go in together, and still your fingers on your lips, I pray, say nothing. The time is out of joint. Oh, cursed spite, that ever I was born to set it right. Why do I have to fix this mess? The whole thing is rotten. I was born to clean up all this. And then, nay come, let's go together, and it is a desperate attempt to hold on to a little bit of human community. Family destroyed, kingdom destroyed, everything. Nay come, let's go together. It's heartbreaking. Question remains. He is sworn to remember the ghost. He feels an obligation to root the evil out of Denmark. Says that he will do it, but the question is, why? Why should I be the one? And it's a fair question, and with that question, we head into the second act, all right? Which we'll pick up with tomorrow morning. Father Doran, would you just... the comment you were making about the ghost after the film.
Seems kind of difficult to say that it's not from hell. Because if you look at the different things which the spirit does, in order to have an act of goodness, it has to be integrally whole. If there's missing any part of an action, it becomes evil. So if you look at the beginning when the ghost appears, and the middle of the effects, and the end, you have to look at all three in order to see the integrity for it to be good. If the lowest is good, then the beginning will be good, the middle will be good, and the end will be good. If the end is bad, or the middle is bad, or the beginning is bad, then it will be an evil action. And therefore the spirit will have to have been an evil source. Right? So if you look in the beginning, you see that fear. I don't have all the references. I'll try to give you some of the references. There is a great amount of fear which you see in the beginning. In the middle, you see an augmentation of hatred and anger amongst anyone who comes into contact with Hamlet. And in the end, of course, there's just corpses strewn all over the stage. Everyone, all these people are dead. There is fear in the very beginning, as Dr. mentioned. And there is a sadness which is increased. When they talk about the face of the ghost, what did he look? It was more sad than angry.
Sorrow than in anger.
So the not anger, but the sorrow when the cock crowed. And as soon as the morning came, there was this, because he was making the speak, correct? Making the speak. So they first described those who had seen him, though he hadn't said anything. The sorrow which is associated. In the discernment of spirits, you know classically, that when the devil comes to tempt, he will take you toward secrecy. Because he doesn't want his temptation exposed. What is the very first thing that this ghost does? Who has been walking here? We know of at least two occasions, and maybe more. At least two. The very first thing he does when Hamlet is there is to call him away. To come away with him. And the only reason why the other ones come is because they go against Hamlet's wishes to leave him alone. So the very first thing what this spirit does is take him away from those whom he loves. And then once that is done, obviously Hamlet seems to be inspired from the ghost to make them all swear to secrecy. If it wasn't inspired directly by the ghost from what he says, it is very clear that that is at least behind it, because the ghost himself orders them to swear to secrecy, not to breathe a thing of this at all. So you see right in the very beginning the fear, and also in the beginning this idea of seclusion. Don't tell anyone. This will be our thing. This is your vengeance. You're the one who has to spare everything. You're the one who has to rectify it. So you have those two things. If you apply the discernment of spirits, it seems pretty clear that it's not a good spirit in the beginning. It also seems to be fostering an occasion of sin on the part of Hamlet. In Act 1, Scene 2, about line 266, I'll speak to it though hell itself should gape and bid me hold my peace. No matter what comes, hell or high waters, I'm going to go, I'm going to follow, and I'm going to talk to this thing. Right? It also seems that it's more of a catalyst. Would the night were come. And he says very clearly that foul deeds will arise up to, what is it, up to men's eyes. Though the world overwhelm, ends up to men's eyes. So he is disposed to even evil, which is there. Right? And then in Act 1, Scene 4, you see very clearly when he greets that he is disposed to speak, even if this is a damned goblin. Even if this is a spirit from hell, he's going to talk to it. It seems to be more of an occasion of sin that he walks into freely, which is taken advantage of, you see. Because he says very clearly, even if this is evil, I'm going to investigate this and I'm going to hear what it has to say. In the middle, where you have the whole playing out of the people who are in closest contact with Hamlet are either thrown, like Ophelia, into a melancholy and lose their mind and commit suicide, or wind up dying. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are excellent examples of those who are just simply associated in this. So there's an increase of hatred which you see augmenting. So the middle is also apparently evil. The ghost being a catalyst, Hamlet being the protagonist, still there is something surrounding which the ghost acts to propel into action. Right? And it also, there is a great moment of self-awareness, it seems, in Act 2, Scene 2, I venture to say, I don't know. when he speaks about the fact that the angel who can appear himself, yes, the devil can appear as an angel. Actu sintu. At the end of Act 2, about line 627, 628, the spirit that I have seen may be a devil, and the devil hath power to assume a pleasing shape. Yea, and perhaps out of my weakness and my melancholy, as he is very potent with such spirits, abuses me to damn me. He has to tell himself this is an honest ghost, this is an honest ghost, but here it seems to be a moment of awareness, of self-revelation. So he's going to try to prove it, but of course the devil himself can know the murder which has been committed. And in Act 3, Scene 2, when he speaks of the very moment in which this being, which is supposed to be his father, keeps appearing, which he calls the witching time of night. Act 3, Scene 2.
Very end of
the scene. The very end again. It is now the very witching time of night, when churchyards yawn and hell itself breathes out contagion to this world. Now could I drink hot blood. It's clear he's obviously been fostered a little bit in the realm of hatred, augmented his anger, and do such bitter business as the day would quake to look on. Which of course is the point when when this ghost is supposed to be being punished. But there's one, he seems to have one claim though at the bottom. Let me be cruel, not unnatural. I will speak daggers to her, but use none. And of course, then if you look at the end, you have madness, real madness, not just fake, but real madness, suicide, murders, and of course death everywhere. And you see especially in Ophelia, who has to be one of the most tragic characters in literature, with not only her madness and the suicide, but she is in a sense completely innocent. She's done nothing, and she's only been obedient to her father to cut off Hamlet's visits. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern seem to be, other than being somewhat naive by listening to their buddy's mother's requests, seem to be innocent bystanders in their death. And then, of course, you see in the hatred which augments in Hamlet. And Claudius becomes worse, because not only from the one first murder, he also then begins to instigate other murder, namely Hamlet's. And of course, Laertes, who seems just the kind of a college kid at the beginning, becomes a hateful and vindictive himself at the end. So if you judge by the beginning and the middle of the end, of which all three need to be present for an integrity in order to have a good action which comes forth from this source which seems to be the ghost, it would seem to be somewhat against it. So I don't know. So discerning.
I agree with everything Father said, and tomorrow I will have much to say in defense of this Hamlet. So, the complicated